You can't hide your lying eyes and your smile as a thin disguise. I thought by now you'd realize there ain't no way to hide your lying eyes.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jeffrey Stempel, who is the Doris S. and Theodore B. Lee Professor of Law at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas's William S. Boyd School of Law. He has extensive experience in insurance law and has authored books and articles on the subject, including Litigation Road, The Story of Campbell versus State Farm, and Stempel on Insurance Law. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeffrey Stempel.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And clearly, in the wake of this superstorm, Sandy, insurance is going to play a huge role. And a lot of people are discovering that there's a thing called a hurricane deductible, which means that unlike most deductibles, this could be up to 1 to 5% of the property value of your home. So if your home is worth $250,000, you could end up paying $12,500 as a deductible. That's serious sticker shock.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And you understand why insurers do it, because they want to try to soften the blow when the disaster hits. And of course, a hurricane of this magnitude presents an even bigger problem, perhaps, because of the wide geographic area. You know, the theory of insurance is that you spread the risk among differently situated people in a different geographic area. But this storm is so wide and caused so much damage throughout that anybody who's underwriting either personal or business property risks in the area, any insurer is going to be hard-pressed by this. And so insurers, you know, basically since Hurricane Andrew in 1992, which hit Miami, you know, one of the few hurricanes at the time that it really hit a heavily populated area. And since then, insurers have tried to protect themselves with these sorts of things. But most policyholders are blissfully and now not so blissfully unaware of it until disaster strikes.
So the costs of this are being estimated between $5 and $10 billion. That comes from EKCAT, right? That's the insurance loss projection firm. But there's a distinction here, which I want to figure out from you, between insured value and economic value. So that means that there are two different figures. If $10 billion insurers lost, but there could be up to $50 billion in other losses. So what's the difference there?
And two things. You can sometimes have things that are insured and things that are uninsured because they're specifically excluded, you know, a particular piece of property or something that isn't renewed, or you may have people who don't have high enough limits. But more to the point of your question, certain things that we value as an economic matter are not necessarily physically tangible and thus are not typically insured under the typical property policy. So an example for that would be if my home gets knocked over, the cost of rebuilding the home will be covered, subject to possible depreciation if I don't have a replacement cost policy. But the disruption that it causes me, whether I'm it depends on the policy, but frequently certain sorts of dislocation and lost time and the sweat equity every homeowner or every business person has to put in is typically not paid for. And if you don't buy it specifically, you may not have what's called business interruption loss. And that is, unfortunately, it's a coverage that costs more, and as a result, many policyholders elect not to get it or don't buy too much of it. And when you have a situation where the infrastructure is down and the transit is down and the commerce is down for weeks or months, you could have a situation where there are a lot of true economic losses suffered by particularly a business, but they may not be insured losses.
And again, this shouldn't be surprising that there's a pattern developing here. You mentioned the first one, Andrew, but since then, of course, Katrina, then Irene, and now Sandy. The big German reinsurance company, Munich Re, it had this prescient report that was distributed by Travelers. And it argued that the U.S., because of its densely populated coasts and vast territory, is unique in being prone to disproportionately from weather-related events. Quoting, nowhere in the world is the rising number of natural catastrophes more evident than in North America. Since 1980, the U.S. has suffered more than $1 trillion in weather-related damage and just more than $500 billion in insured losses. So tell us about the role of these reinsurance giants and the fact that they are really waking up to global warming.
And I should give Munich Re credit. I've seen reports of theirs going back 6, 7, 8 years, so they've been ahead of the curve. And I must say, at the risk of sounding politically incorrect during an election season, the European insurers have been quicker to recognize this and are often a little more sensitive to emerging issues. The American carriers tend to be, by the book, more conservative, slower to adapt. So, and now, fortunately, reinsurance is important, and reinsurance has been referred to as even a silent regulator because some insurers really can't do much business unless they can get the reinsurance. So Munich Re, Swiss Re, Lloyd's of London, those are all major reinsurance markets. And now that they have awakened, hopefully that'll have a positive impact because they recognize that the danger this poses. I should add that Europe is not scot-free. Some very huge losses have taken place during winter storms in northern and western Europe. But as the report noted, the U.S. is particularly vulnerable. And then, of course, at the risk of again wading into a political thicket, the U.S. has been slow to really come to terms with what certainly every credible scientist now recognizes as a problem of climate change and increasingly rising temperatures that create less than completely predictable havoc, other than that we can predict that there will be more of these disasters unless there's some sort of an attempt to control the carbon fuels. And as we saw in New York, it's probably time for regions of the country that don't think of themselves as in a national or natural disaster belt to begin to build up to code standards. The most obvious example being the crane that we've seen dangling in New York that was built to withstand up to 90-mile-an-hour winds. But my understanding is the state-of-the-art will get you a crane that can withstand 140 or 150-mile-an-hour winds, but they don't want to spend that kind of money outside of the Gulf area. Well, I think it's now clear that any time you're anywhere, you may need to have to spend that kind of money to make sure that cranes and buildings and infrastructure is appropriately supported going forward. But the reinsurers, we hope, will have an impact by kind of waking everybody up. And if nothing else, we can try to get coverages that are more tailored to things. We can get better building standards, and we can have a commensurate premium. No one likes to pay high insurance premiums, but better that the insurance be there and that it be solvent and able to respond than to have a situation where we have these huge gaps in coverage like we're seeing consistently after situations like Irene and Katrina and now Sandy.
Again, I'm speaking with Jeffrey Stemple, who is professor of law at the University of Nevada School of Law, and he has extensive experience in insurance law and has authored the books Litigation Road, The Story of Campbell versus State Farm, and Stemple on Insurance Law. So what is then the difference between a reinsurance company like Munich Re and insurance? What's the role that reinsurance plays?
And reinsurance is basically insurance for insurers. So if I'm the Acme Insurance Company, I will frequently purchase reinsurance, and reinsurance can be done on what's called a facultative basis for a particular risk, or there can be what's called a treaty, which is a reinsurance agreement across a number of risks that a particular insurer has. And essentially, there are also different formats where the reinsurance may share pro rata the loss that an insurer suffers, or it may step in after there's a certain point of attachment that's been breached. So it's a way for the insurers to basically protect themselves against the contingency that there'll be something they haven't properly calculated for or predicted that will put their own funds under stress. In normal times, insurers are basically invisible banks. They have large accumulations of money, and typically no, if it's just normal activity, you don't have a run on the bank. But after a large disaster of this magnitude, same with an earthquake, you can have sort of what's the insurance equivalent of a run on the bank. And if insurers don't have proper reinsurance in place, they better be awfully big and awfully solvent and have awfully deep pockets. So that's why companies like Munich Re and Swiss Re and the Lloyd's syndicates, you know, are an important backstop, and they're the source of where you would go to get the really big dollars that will be put in play when you have a disaster like this.
We saw what happened with AIG, which was the largest insurance company here in the United States, and they seem to have decided to get off into other risky territory rather than sticking to what they know, and the taxpayer had to bail them out.
And that's really a true failure of regulation, but also too much greed and maybe too much faddishness. The AIG insurers were all, you know, quite healthy, as one insurance regulator described them at a meeting I was at, basically bricks of gold sunk in the mud being all the financial speculation that AIG had undergone, but the actual insuring operation was pretty solid, and some of that is because they know what they're doing. Some of that is because they're not, they weren't always the easiest company to collect from when claims were made, and so they had managed that part of the business pretty well. But to the extent that you commingle insurance with other financial services and become more speculative, that, in my view at least, undermines the kind of security and solvency and predictable risk spreading that you want an insurance company to be able to accomplish. You know, if you will, sort of there's a social purpose as well as an economic purpose. So that's, in my view, one of the reasons you can justify some of the favorable regulations insurers have. For example, they're exempt from antitrust laws, and they are considered to be contracts that are affected with the public interest. But if you're not careful, and if the insurer behaves like a day derivative trader, we saw that can create some real havoc with the markets and undermine the otherwise very solvent insurance part of the operation.
So, Jeffrey Stemple, let's talk about then the politics of the situation here and the extent to which, as you mentioned earlier, these reinsurance giants like Munich Re, who see the writing on the wall vis-a-vis global warming, and they're the ones that put up the real money, in effect. But you're saying that in the United States they're not as aware, or perhaps they're politically blind because it is a political issue. In fact, the current candidate for the Republican Party and the entire Republican Party is pretty much on record as in denial of global warming. So, and I mean, since insurance here in the United States is a state-regulated matter, what will happen then when these big reinsurance giants like Munich Re and others are saying to the regulators, we have got to raise premiums because global warming is happening and we're going to incur further crippling losses? And the insurance regulator, who's a political appointee, say in a red state, says, well, I don't know what you're worried about. You know, global warming is a fraud.
Well, and we have the same problem, unfortunately, potentially in a blue state where the insurance regulator wants to run for potentially higher office or be perceived as a consumer advocate. And, of course, the easy way to do that is say, I kept premiums low. And then when the disaster strikes, if there are problems of solvency later, that regulator has been replaced by another regulator. So we have a real principal agent consistency problem. But I see two different potential scenarios here, and I'm not sure which will win out. I think the good scenario, if you will, is that insurers could play a role like they've done historically. I think the classic example is what happened in the early part of the 20th century, where insurers created an underwriter's laboratory. It was created by underwriters for to serve the underwriting of the insurance industry to try to move for more safe electronic devices, and so we now started to have UL-approved plugs and cords and lamps and other devices over the years, and as a result, there was a real downturn in the number of home fires and sparks and electrocutions. And so the insurance industry really did play a very positive role in safety and society at that point. And you could see potentially a similar thing happening here, because it's certainly an industry with considerable clout. And it could lobby not only to say we need better premiums and we need to provide more comprehensive coverage so there aren't these gaps, but it could also be effective in lobbying for sounder building regulations, better coastline treatment, maybe even as something as simple as what was suggested in the New York Times over the weekend, getting the oysters back in the bays around New York as a natural break from the storm surge. You could see that happening. On the other hand, there are some very powerful interest groups that are aligned basically, as you suggested, in denial, or at least in terms of short-term economic maximization, and they're fighting any kind of regulation tooth and nail. The energy industry in particular, I guess, is probably the number one culprit. And in that battle among well-heeled industries, I'm not sure who will win. One problem I think that the insurance industry has may be, and I don't claim to be an insider, but I think there's a little discontinuity of goals. The property and casualty insurers really feel the problems related to natural disaster and climate change. And those are the folks who do the property insurance and the homeowners insurance and so on, because when they have a loss, it hits big, it hits one at once, there are a lot of claims to pay. Other insurers spread their risk over time and have other ways of managing the risk that make them less vulnerable. For example, a liability insurer, someone who defends the policyholder if they're in an auto accident, or a business if they're sued in a tort claim, that claim can stretch over years. It usually gets paid back in inflated dollars. It can be settled sometimes for less than its full value. In the meantime, the insurance company has the money in the bank. There isn't the same run-on-the-bank problem you get in the immediate aftermath of the big destruction of a hurricane. And it's my view, at least, that that part of the industry has been considerably less concerned about getting involved in the sort of things that will reduce the exposure for their property and casualty insurance brethren. Now, sometimes you have all these companies under one corporate arm and so on, but I think there's a significant difference in the level of urgency that different parts of the insurance industry feel. If you could get the entire industry at the level of concern of, say, a Munich Re, that would be a pretty powerful lobbying force, and it might even be enough to stand up to big oil. But all bets are off, and at the micro level, it even matters who's in charge of a congressional committee or who's in the governor's office, and maybe it even matters whether it's a swing state or not, and all that makes it very hard to do what I would regard as sort of the rational risk management course of action, because it's inevitably going to get mired in the politics and some of the personal agendas that some of these actors are going to have.
Well, just in closing, Jeffrey Stempel, Governor Cuomo of New York said on Tuesday, we have a new reality when it comes to these weather patterns. We have an old infrastructure and we have old systems, and that is not a good combination. So in terms of this battle between big oil and coal versus the insurance companies about the reality of global warming, you would think, though, that given the financialization of our economy, which is about at 50%, and the power of Wall Street, they all live there. The battery is exactly where they live, and that's what was underwater. So these financial titans have actually gotten their toes wet.
And maybe this will be the thing that sort of brings it home to a part of the, if you will, the power structure that has not been in the forefront on this issue. And it's a great point. And, you know, again, depending on one's, whether one's a Keynesian or a different sort of economist, one could argue that there would be some significant economic benefit to doing the things that we probably should be doing anyhow in order to make the country more resilient against these sort of episodic disasters.
Well, Jeffrey Stempel, I thank you for joining us.
You're welcome, Ian. Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Jeffrey Stemple, who is the Doris S. and Theodore B. Lee Professor of Law at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas' William S. Boyd School of Law. He has extensive experience in insurance law and has authored books and articles on the subject, including Litigation Road, The Story of Campbell versus State Farm, and Stemple on Insurance Law. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about how you can vote for third parties and feel good about it and not have a repeat of Florida 2000.
In this sacred land, it has seen many hands. It has wealth and gold, yet it is fragile and old. And now the greedy souls just don't care to know of the changes it will confront. So you know some people, they just won't understand. No, they just won't understand these things. Thank you for your message, but I don't understand. No, I just